Coming up, Fred DeSam Lazaro on China's pollution. Should China's customers, such as the U.S., help pay for its cleanup? And Kim Lawton looks at Native American Catholics and their devotion to St. Kateri Tekakwitha, the church's first Native American saint.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was in Washington this past week for discussions about the stalled Middle East peace process and the relationship between the U.S. and Israel. At the White House, Netanyahu said he's not given up hope for peace. He also appeared before thousands at the Jewish Federations of North America General Assembly. He urged U.S. Jews to put aside their divisions over the Iran deal and unite in strong support for Israel. Netanyahu also told the group his government would work harder to ensure that the reform and conservative branches of Judaism have more religious influence inside Israel. Currently, the Orthodox dominate religious life there. Pope Francis continues to insist on reforms in the Vatican bureaucracy, despite the release of two books based on leaked documents that detail the uphill battle he faces in doing that. The Italian journalists responsible for the books, which allege greed and financial misconduct, are currently under investigation by the Vatican. Also this week, Francis spoke before thousands of Italian bishops and laypeople at a meeting in Florence intended to outline a comprehensive vision for the future of the Roman Catholic Church. He emphasized that church teachings are always subject to change and meant to generate questions. There were also renewed concerns about Francis's health. He has stumbled a few times recently, and last month an Italian newspaper reported that the Pope was suffering from a benign brain tumor. The Vatican denied that and insisted the pontiff is in good health. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Mormons, is facing a backlash over a new policy announced last week that bans the baptism of the children of same-sex couples and declares married gay couples apostates. Under the new edict, children of gay couples can be baptized only after they're no longer living with their parents or after renouncing same-sex relationships. Many Mormons are now threatening to leave the church because of the new policy. Faith-based groups are reacting to last week's announcement that the Supreme Court will hear arguments about whether the contraception provisions in the Affordable Care Act violate the rights of religious nonprofit groups. Last year, the justices ruled that Hobby Lobby and some other for-profit businesses could not be required to cover contraception for their employees if the owners objected on religious grounds. At issue now is the extent to which religious nonprofits may be exempt. Currently, they have to fill out a form to opt out of providing coverage. Several groups, including an order of nuns and many Christian colleges, say that violates their religious freedom. Religious groups are coming down on both sides of the issue. Also this week, many faith-based activists urged the Supreme Court to take up a controversial immigration case. The Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled against President Obama's plan to protect millions of illegal immigrants from deportation. A wide range of religious groups has lobbied for the plan as a way of keeping families together. They're calling on the High Court to let the plan move forward. Young Catholics from across the country gathered in Washington as part of the 18th Ignatian Family Teach-In for Justice. Hundreds of high school and university students from Jesuit institutions Listen to a series of speakers who focused on two key social justice issues, climate change and immigration reform. A social justice rally on Capitol Hill on Monday capped off the weekend's activity. As they prepared to lobby members of Congress, young adults heard from faith leaders.
Use this moment to build bridges, transform our nation, and give people hope. Because you are the hope for our future. You are how change will happen.
Also this week, in an unusual collaboration, the U.S. Department of State and Georgetown University hosted a two-day symposium on religion and climate change. Faith leaders, scholars, and government policymakers gathered to address the theological underpinnings of climate change advocacy. The meeting was scheduled in advance of a UN summit on climate change that begins in Paris later this month. As world leaders prepare for that summit, one major concern is the pollution caused by China, whose enormous growth in manufacturing has come with little environmental protection. But Fred DeSam Lazaro introduces us to a Chinese activist, a private citizen, who is using information and publicity to persuade factories to clean up their waste. Meanwhile, a hard question: do China's customers, many of them in the U.S., have a responsibility to help pay for China's cleanup?
The inspectors came calling recently at this massive textile factory in the eastern city of Hangzhou. The plant is part of the San Juan Company, one of the icons of China's rapid rise as a manufacturing powerhouse. It produces 2 billion feet of patterned and dyed fabric each year for garment makers and fashion houses around the world. This plant also produces some 60,000 tons of wastewater, and a 2013 investigation found it was not being adequately treated. Manager Wang Wei says millions of dollars were invested to upgrade the system.
Today, we invited IPE in to show them our changes, our improvement in environmental protection, so their inspectors can see we are in compliance with government requirements.
But IPE, the inspectors, are not from the all-powerful government. The Institute of Public and Environmental Affairs is a small, non-government organization.
IPE has been a real force of nature here on environmental issues. They are completely unique. I tease Ma Jun that he's one in a billion.
Ma Jun.
IPE's founder Ma Jun has won international awards for environmental activism that has taken on China's powerful industrial establishment. He's done so with political savvy and technology, says Linda Greer of the Washington-based Natural Resources Defense Council, which has partnered with IPE.
I think he's an astute observer of what are the problems and how can they best be solved in China.
But Greer says it's the world's moral responsibility to solve China's pollution problem.
The world made a decision to concentrate its manufacturing in one country. More than 50% of the manufacturing of the world occurs here. It's like we took the pollution from the United States and Europe and other parts of the world and just centered it here.
Ma was an investigative journalist in the 1990s when he began documenting the toll of China's industrialization, environmental and human.
Like, you know, in those cancer village, a group of old ladies kneeling down in front of me, you know, holding a bottle of polluted water and hoping that they get help. This is the voice that got drowned in this complex globalized supply chain system.
Hundreds of millions of Chinese have been exposed to health hazards, he says, and things are approaching a tipping point.
If we don't handle that right, this will not just threaten our social stability, but it could hinder the very economic growth itself.
It's not hard to get a sense of public concern, even anger.
The air is not good, and it's getting worse and worse, very bad.
At the sidewalk barbershops outside the industrial city of Tianjin, people shared their feelings, though not their names.
You do feel the pollution when you breathe. It's a lot more polluted than before. The water is also polluted, and our food.
The officials are corrupt. People with money can buy favor. Corrupt officials are everywhere.
Ma Jun says this growing political will in Beijing to tackle the environment crisis, standards have been tightened, and factories are now required to report their emission levels in real time. IPE puts this dense information into a database accessible to the general public, on the web and now on mobile.
This is a large power plant just outside the industrial city of Tianjin, and it's one of thousands of industrial sites across the country that are monitored. And that information is readily available to anyone who's downloaded the IPE app onto their smartphone. As it turns out, this plant today is well within the range of allowable emissions. As you can see, there are dozens of plants being monitored. Some of them are in the red zone, and the one that we're standing in front of comes in F33.
By itself, this information has minimal impact. Local officials, where factories are located, are rewarded for economic growth, for creating jobs. They're often indifferent about pollution, says Greer.
One of my favorite expressions I've learned in China is one that says, the sky is high and the emperor is far away. That there's sort of a nobody will ever know mentality down there at the provincial and local level.
So IPE has taken its concern to the global level, to customers of the polluting factories. Ma says they are much more sensitive about their public image. When it found the Hangzhou factory out of compliance, for example, IPE contacted big buyers, including Nike, Walmart, Gap, and H&M.
Because they made very clear commitment to sustainable manufacturing and sourcing. And we just want to hold them accountable for that.
IPE convinced our brand customers not to place any order from any supplier who did not meet their environmental requirements. IPE is trusted by the public, and we can trust their data.
Because of its size, Wang says his company was able to afford the $30-plus million upgrade, but he says that may not be true of all suppliers, who are often pressured by their brand customers to lower costs. Ma Jun says the solution is to make information accessible to all parties.
Many stakeholders would like to join the efforts, including even the polluters themselves. You know, they pollute. It's not because morally they have a problem, but more because the mechanism now is rewarding those who cut corners to save cost. So I think that we can level the playing field.
One way IPE and its American partner, NRDC, do that is by publishing an annual transparency index.
And today I would like to announce the top 100 brands and their rankings and scores.
The index ranks international brands on how they've dealt with suppliers that are violating pollution laws.
Scores have been on the rise, and the score for Apple has exceeded 70 points.
Apple ranks number one. Ironic, since that company initially declined to work with IPE. Today, Apple and several global brands like retailer Target are willing partners who use the group's data as a resource.
We look at IPE to ensure that there are no irregularities. What is the progress of our suppliers that have irregularities that need to be reported?
Other American companies like Macy's, JCPenney, and Victoria's Secret were rated at zero. They insist they have their own systems of environmental protection and say they've never heard from IPE. Ma says it's possible they may not have heard of his group, since non-government organizations are small and relatively new in China.
This is a time for the NGOs in China to build its capacity and reputation.
In time, he expects more companies will come on board, especially as IPE adds their brand names onto the next version of its mobile app. He says it will link brands to the factories being tracked so consumers can make informed purchases.
First of all, a little bit about the Natural Resources Defense Council.
IPE's American partner says Western consumers also have a moral responsibility to buy green, even if that means higher prices.
China's pollution problem is caused by about one-third by export to America and to Western Europe. So this pollution is our pollution, and I think we have an ethical obligation to help reduce it.
And even as China begins cleaning up, Xi and Ma Jun fear the global supply chain will migrate to less expensive countries, eager as China was a generation ago to attract new factories, but lacking the systems to safeguard the environment. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Fred DeSam-Lazaro in Tianjin, China.
This is Native American Heritage Month, and we have a special report. An estimated 25% of Native Americans are Catholic. In many areas, there are longstanding tensions between the Catholic Church and indigenous tribes, in part because early missionary efforts were tied to colonization, which was often devastating to Native cultures. Kim Lawton looks at St. Kateri Tekakwitha, the Church's first Native American saint. Many Native American Catholics look to her to help bridge the gap.
This is the grand entry procession at the annual Tekakwitha Conference. Native American Catholics from more than 100 indigenous tribes across the U.S. and Canada have gathered to show their devotion to St. Kateri Tekakwitha, a 17th century convert to Catholicism and the Church's first Native American saint.
After all these centuries, the love of her people has seemed to just been a contagious type of love that has swept right across the country.
St. Kateri, or as some call her, St. Kateri, is a vivid symbol of the Catholic Church's complicated relationship with indigenous people. For many, she represents the diversity of a church that has been embraced across racial and cultural lines.
It means a lot to have somebody like St. Kateri, who is being held up by the whole Catholic Church, as well as someone who is recognized and respected and greatly esteemed throughout the whole world.
But for some Native Americans, she represents the pain of colonization and missionary activities that were seen as destroying indigenous culture and religion.
We believe the Creator gave everybody their own spirituality. So if he gave it to Europeans or to people in the Middle East, you know, and then that's for them, you know, and not for us.
Nicknamed the Lily of the Mohawks, Kateri was born in the mid-1600s in what is now New York State. She lived in a Mohawk village that was part of the Iroquois Confederacy.
There's a series of epidemics that pass through this part of the world. Terrible smallpox that when she's 6 years old, she is very ill with. It has a permanent effect on her health. She loses both her parents.
Alan Greer is professor of history at McGill University in Montreal and author of the book Mohawk Saint. He says as a young woman, Kateri began studying with Jesuit missionaries in the area and decided to become baptized.
There's more specific detailed information on her life than on any Indian person of North, South, Central America at the time of initial encounter with Europeans. So she's uniquely well documented.
The Jesuits documented much of Kateri's life in their journals. They described how after her conversion, the young woman moved to the Jesuit mission at Ganawage, near what is now Montreal, where there were many Native converts.
What made her stand out, along with several other young Mohawk women, is she practiced an extreme form of what religious scholars would call mystic asceticism. A religious practice that involves inflicting deliberate pain and discomfort on the body as a way of empowering the spirit.
Kateri's health was always weak, and she died in 1680 when she was around 24 years old. Almost immediately, stories about her charity, devotion, and purity began to spread, as did stories of miracles. Leona Gonzalez of the Tuscarora tribe in New York recounts one miracle story involving the smallpox scars on Kateri's face.
She's dying, and she mentions, "Jesus, I love you." And according to the journals written in French by the Jesuits, the pox marks all disappeared from her.
An effort to see Kateri officially recognized as a saint was launched in 1884, but the church's complicated process for sainthood usually takes decades. In 2011, the Vatican certified the final required miracle. A young boy of Native American descent, Jake Finkbonner, was cured of a life-threatening case of flesh-eating bacteria after family and friends prayed that St. Kateri would intercede with God for him. One of those praying at Jake's bedside was Sister Kateri Mitchell. She is executive director of the National Tekakwitha Conference. Mitchell says Catholics across the country have formed Kateri prayer circles.
They're really a powerhouse of prayer when they gather. So many of our people have received multiple favors in praying and through her intercession, and many who have received a lot of healing.
Gonzalo says St. Kateri interceded for her as well, although it wasn't officially recognized as a miracle.
I had thyroid cancer 14 years ago, and with her help, it's gone. Surgery removed all of thyroid and all of the cancer.
When Kateri was canonized at the Vatican in October 2012, Gonzalez and several family members were there.
She's always been our saint. Always.
But for many Native Americans, the issue of indigenous people converting to Catholicism remains a sensitive one. During his visit to the U.S., Pope Francis canonized Father Junipero Serra, an 18th century Spanish missionary who brought Christianity to California. Some Native Americans protested the canonization, arguing that missionary efforts were tied to colonization, which was devastating to indigenous cultures.
The problem was is that Christians weren't honest, and that's how we lost our land. They lied to us, and they also felt superior to us and betrayed us. And I think they betrayed our trust, and they used religion.
In many areas, tensions persist between Catholicism and traditional Native religions, which are often practiced in a longhouse.
At a very early age, around 12 or 13 years old, I was an altar boy at the time, and I was sitting on the altar one day during Mass, and I was looking around, and I was wondering to myself, what am I doing here? You know, there's nothing in this, in the church, in the Mass or anything that I could identify with, as a young Mohawk.
But Native American Catholics take a more nuanced view. Father Maurice Henry Sands directs the Black and Indian Mission Office founded by the U.S. Catholic bishops.
And there have been lots of negative things that have also come along with the Europeans who came that also impact us to the present day. As a believer, as a priest, I don't have any hesitation to say that the coming of the gospel of Jesus Christ to the Americas is the best thing that has happened for us.
We reflect, we remember, but let us let go, let us heal, and we need to move forward.
Leaders at the Tekakwitha Conference say there doesn't need to be a conflict between Native ancestry and Catholicism. That's something they try to teach to the next generation. Tasha Smith first came to the conference as a child.
And so it was the first time as an 11-year-old coming to me like, wow, these people know how to sing in their native language, and they're praying in their native language, and it was just an amazing experience.
Native American Catholics say the church is doing a better job of celebrating diversity than it had in the past.
Since Vatican II, there's a much greater openness to the expressions of cultures, inclusion of cultures in liturgies and in our life as Catholics.
Nature has always played a key role in Native spirituality, and that's true for Native American Catholics as well. They were greatly inspired by Pope Francis's encyclical on the environment, especially his many assertions about the close ties between humans and the earth.
I have met a number of people from other cultures who have said it was like reading something that a native person, first people of this land, would write. So I think now Native spirituality is taking deeper roots within the hearts of our Christian people.
Many Native Americans believe that's one more example of how the Catholic Church is moving beyond the mistakes of the past. I'm Kim Lawton reporting.
Finally, a scandalous typo sold big at auction this week. An early King James version of the Bible contained a misprint of the seventh commandment, so it said, "Thou shalt commit adultery." One of those Bibles was auctioned off in London for $47,000. The printing error was spotted in 1632, a year after 1,000 copies had circulated in England. The so-called Sinner's Bible has remained a collector's item ever since. That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook and watch us anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. There's also much more on our website where you can listen to or watch every program. Join us at pbs.org/religionethics. As we leave you, music from a Mass in honor of St. Kateri at St. Francis Xavier Catholic Church in Quebec.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Be more. PBS.